Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. Just about everybody in America has heard of Yellowstone National Park, the world's first national park established in 1872. But how would we describe its purpose? To protect wild animals? To preserve wild and exceptional landscapes? To enable us Americans to enjoy these places forever? If that is a fair summary, what happens if the purposes come into conflict to some degree, whether within the park or with its neighbors? Dan Wenk knows. He's Yellowstone Park Superintendent. Dan, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground.
Pleasure to be with you today.
And thanks for inviting us to come. It was a fantastic trip here. As you know, I'm with a young Cuban paleontologist colleague. It's the first time in Montana. We saw bison and a sow grizzly with a cub. It was just fantastic.
Well, you're having the same experience that tens of thousands of people will have over this weekend. And they enjoy their national parks and they enjoy Yellowstone greatly.
Tell us a little about your background.
I actually grew up in Michigan. We lived in a small farming community. My father was not a farmer, but he had an automobile repair business in the Ann Arbor, Michigan area. And my connection with nature, if you will, came through, I lived in the country. All my uncles were farmers around me. We had a cabin in the woods in northern Michigan, and I probably had my first national park experience not until I went to college.
What led from your interest in the outdoors and exposure to nature to a career with the Park Service?
I'm professionally trained as a landscape architect, and I practiced landscape architecture early in my career with the National Park Service. In fact, came to Yellowstone as the park landscape architect
really?
In 1979.
Now, what would a landscape architect do in Yellowstone Park? My immediate reaction is this landscape doesn't, it's got some natural architecture in its favor.
Well, I think what the primary job was the integration of the built environment, you know, to take care of visitors and visitor needs with the natural environment, to make sure that we did as good of a job as possible to integrate those structures, those facilities, those roads within the natural environment to have as little damage or as little impact on the natural environment. As possible.
Strikes me as an interesting transition from landscape architecture to conservation of landscapes at the scale of the National Park Service. Where's the bridge for you?
Well, the bridge is that every solution to visitor use and enjoyment in a national park is not to build more facilities. It's not the built environment. It's really about what we don't build and what we do build as well. And I think as a landscape architect, I think I can help I have helped in my career really identify what are appropriate and necessary facilities within a national park. And if they truly are appropriate and necessary, how do we best integrate those facilities within a natural landscape so they're the least intrusive, that they have the lowest amount of impact, and we can provide the services we need to without damaging the landscape?
Appropriate and necessary seem to be very significant words in this context. Fair?
Well, they are. I think it's a primary tenet of National Park Service and our concessions facilities within Yellowstone National Park. An example would be you go to Old Faithful area of Yellowstone National Park. We have a built environment there that's been a built environment since the late 1800s. Mm-hmm. You can look at the changes that have been made at Old Faithful area of Yellowstone over time. We have far less visitor development there. We have concentrated the development so it has less impact. We recognize on a daily basis we have to make changes. We have a great new visitor education facility that was opened in 2010, and that facility was done with great care in terms of the thermal features and the impact on the environment. Removed lots of cabins. We want to get rid of the overpass at Old Faithful because it's incongruous, if you will, with the natural environment to have that overpass there. You can go to Canyon area of Yellowstone National Park and see where we're tearing out many of the old cabins that are in the park and we're replacing them with five lodges. Those five lodges are going to have a far less impact or imprint on the landscape than the cabins had previously. So there's places that we can make significant changes to still maintain a high level of visitor service, you know, within the park, but have less impact on the environment. And I think we make different choices today than certainly we made 50 years ago or even probably 20 years ago. We are in a process where we are trying to remove facilities from the brink, if you will, or the edge of the great natural features. You know, you can go to Old Faithful, which used to be surrounded by more than almost 270 degrees of development. There was hardly a place you could stay and look at the Old Faithful geyser without seeing man's imprint on the background, whether it be cabins or parking lots or roads. And so we've taken the time to move out of those areas. You look at Fishing Bridge. Fishing Bridge had a tremendous or a very large cabin area or overnight stay area. It had a campground, a tent campground at Fishing Bridge as well. Those facilities have been removed from the edge of the lake and along the side of the river. So we are doing things every day that really reduce our impact on the visitors' experience when they're in Yellowstone.
Often in the field of conservation or preservation of the conservation of nature, there are conflicts with what might be called market forces. Now, in this case, there's an internal mission potentially conflicting, preserving the natural features and enhancing people's, enabling people's enjoyment, use and enjoyment. So that's a balancing act. You say it's changed over time. First question is, you said you first came here in 79. Have you changed over time? Has your philosophy changed as you see the same choices?
I think I've changed a lot over time. Grant Village, you know, many people look at Grant Village and look at it and say, why did we ever do Grant Village? I would tell you that that was my job when I came here. The superintendent at that time, John Townsley, said, Dan, I want you to make Grant Village happen. And I did. But it didn't happen for just to build another visitor area in Yellowstone National Park. It happened because that allowed us to get out of old, dilapidated cabins at Old Faithful. It allowed us to get out of the cabins at Fishing Bridge. It allowed us to return landscapes to more of their natural condition. And it didn't increase the number of pillows in the park, so it was a direct response to what were being provided in local communities, where they provide support services for the park based on our pledge, if you will, not to increase the number of overnight capacity within Yellowstone. I think what I've seen is I've seen a general philosophy that I think I have as well, that you don't answer the questions in national parks by building facilities. You answer the questions by really understanding the resource issues that are there and what's the best response. Sometimes it may be to harden a small piece of landscape for parking, or sometimes it may be to build a trail. But oftentimes it's to leave the area alone and to actually have to create distance from some of the great natural features in the park, where people have to experience more on a natural basis than a prepared basis or you know, paved roads or trails that would be built or services that would be provided. But try to give people a great broad experience of what's in a national park, but don't commercialize that experience. And I think in many times in the past, in the early days of Yellowstone National Park, it really was, in many cases, a commercial venture.
I thought I heard you say you made a commitment not to increase the number of beds in the park at some point. Mm-hmm. And they commented about the interests of the communities that serve as the entrances, let's say West Yellowstone, Gardner, I guess Cook City. Let's talk for a second about the commercial interests. They're legitimate and necessary interests broadly in society. They serve the park, but there's a potential conflict. So what are the political or economic realities? What do the entrance communities want from you, and is there any tension in that, any different, when I say tension, different interests on the table that need to be reconciled?
I would say there's a creative tension, which is not necessarily a bad tension at all. The National Park Service has long recognized that we cannot provide all the services that people want in great Western national parks or national parks across the country within the boundaries of the park without actually having a detrimental effect on those park areas. So we depend on local communities. I think there's an important commitment that we've made in the planning documents for Yellowstone that have said we will limit the number of campsites that we have in the park. We will limit the number of hotel rooms and beds that we have in the park. We will limit the number of services that we provide in the park, and that businesses outside of the park then therefore can make plans and they can go into building a new hotel or a gift shop or a restaurant with certainty that the National Park Service is not going to undercut them, if you will, by building more things in a park. Typically, the first areas that we'll fill in terms of campgrounds or hotel rooms are the rooms or campsites in Yellowstone National Park. But we can't serve the number of visitors without having a great relationship with the communities that surround the park, who also provide beds, restaurants, opportunities for people to enjoy things outside the park as well. So I think it's a relationship we work on. It's a relationship we try to strengthen with our partners, and I do call them our partners. I often tell these communities, however, that we care about their economy, we're concerned about their economy, but we're not responsible for it, because there's a lot of cases where people would like to see even less services provided within Yellowstone National Park, which would help their businesses.
Yeah.
But I think there's a balance that I think we've been very faithful to our commitments to them in terms of the numbers of beds, the numbers of campsites, and what we will provide. So I'm very comfortable with where we are, and I want to maintain that. It also comes into play oftentimes with opening of roads in the spring and shutting down roads in the fall. How long of a season? The government shutdown last year was very harmful to many businesses and surrounding communities because we lost a lot of visitors through the first 15 days of October because they did not come to the park.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Yellowstone Park Superintendent Dan Wank. Concessionaires are people that have business in the park. Now,
right.
It seems to me they must have a different point of view. Fundamentally, if I'm in business in the park, I would like to see expansive services for the same reason that the businesses perhaps in the periphery of the park want to see containment, right?
I think they would if they were left to their own devices, but they operate in the park on a concession contract, that they have a contract that they know specifically how many rooms, what restaurants, what their seasons of operation will be. So there's no false expectation when they enter the contract with the federal government in terms of what their operations will be. They never take a contract with the assumption that they'll be able to grow the number of beds that they would be able to sell or the number of restaurants they'll be able to construct or the number of horse rides they'll be able to give. There are limits on those contracts, and we do it through concession contracts because it has been the opinion of the National Park Service and the Congress of the United States that private sector businesses are best positioned to provide those services under contract with the National Park Service.
You earlier said that the park's origins and early history were closely connected with commercial interests. What did you mean?
The early development in Yellowstone was really done by the railroads. They were looking to expand tourism into the west. They were looking to build hotels, provide services through the park that would serve a population that wanted to see these unusual places. They'd heard about them. They wanted to see them. And so many of the Old Faithful Inn was built by built in time to serve the railroad traffic. Earliest hotel was built in 1891, which is now the Lake Hotel. So cars did not come into the park until 1915. Many hotels that were built were oftentimes a day's stagecoach ride apart in the park because of that. You will not see many of the hotels. There used to be a hotel in the Midway Geyser Basin. There used to be another hotel at Yancey's Hole out by Roosevelt. So a lot of what was here is now gone because we have consolidated some of that early activity.
I do like the idea of riding in a stagecoach through Yellowstone Park. I hadn't thought about that.
You can still do it.
I mentioned in the beginning sometime the potential of conflict with neighbors, and I'm thinking bison go inside and outside the park, wolves move in and out, and I gather from occasional reading there are some conflicts there.
I think the biggest issue that we're facing in Yellowstone right now is really the transboundary issues. Wildlife does not respect political boundaries, and whether it be bison, which we have probably the greatest conservation story in America, where we've gone from a population of less than 25 to currently we're somewhere between 4,500 and probably 5,000 bison in Yellowstone National
Park. There were
Park.
Less than 25 bison in Yellowstone National Park?
There were in the early 1900s. And because of all the hunting activity and the removal, there was a lot of what would be called now poaching in the park in the late 1800s. Which was probably the cause for one of the causes for the Lacey Act, and the U.S. Army came in. The U.S. Army was in fact enforcing the laws of Yellowstone National Park until the Park Service was formed in 1916. So there were a lot of things that were going on that were really detrimental. We had a philosophy that many of the predators in Yellowstone National Park were bad, i.e., we eradicated, extirpated wolves from Yellowstone
National
Park.
When was that done?
It was done in the early 1900s, and I'm sorry, I just can't remember the exact date when the last wolf was seen here. But you know, they were gone from the landscape for probably close to 75 plus or minus years. They were not on the landscape in Yellowstone National Park.
So you're talking about now transboundary issues. Give me some concrete examples of what you're speaking about in terms of wildlife.
The capacity for wildlife in Yellowstone National Park has not been reached for many species of animals. There is no shortage of grass, for example, for bison to feed on during the summer months. However, during the winter, when we have high snows, the bison leave the park. They leave the park to seek lower elevations. They seek grass. They cause conflict. Some people consider it safety issues in the Gardner Basin or the Hebgen Basin around the park. Some people look at property damage that bison cause. Other people look at the fact that they carry the disease brucellosis, which will cause or can cause, if transmitted to cattle, for cattle to abort or bison to abort. So therefore, they're not accepted across the wide landscape of Montana. However, elk, which carry the same disease, also travel outside of the park. And a lot more of them, and they are more accepted on the landscape. Unfortunately, elk have transmitted the disease to cattle. Bison, because of our work on spatial and temporal separation from cattle, have never transmitted the disease to cattle. So it's a difficult situation to try to manage. We had this spring, we had up to about 1,100 bison who were outside of the park in the Gardner Basin before they started coming back into the park. We had probably 500 or 600 outside of the park in the Hebgen Basin on the west side of the park.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Yellowstone Park Superintendent Dan Wenk. When you have those situations, what do you do about it? In other words, you've got different jurisdictions. You work for the federal government, National Park Service. You've got national forest land. You have the state of Montana. Let's just talk about bison. You have agricultural interests that have been very nervous for a long time about brucellosis, ironically, which came from cattle originally to bison. How does it play out? Who do you interface with? What's the relationships? What helps make solutions? What inhibits solutions?
Well, we have something we call the Interagency Bison Management Plan Team, which is we're trying to implement the plan that was approved in 2000. We work very directly with the Montana Department of Livestock, the Montana Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. We work with the governor's office. I think we all have a collective goal for two things, and that is, number one, to the greatest extent to maintain a free-ranging, free-roaming herd of bison, and at the same time prohibit the transmission of disease from bison to cattle. We've been very successful at that. We have probably at least monthly conversations, especially between us and the state of Montana and the two agencies that I just mentioned. We try to work as collaboratively as we can. We had a conversation earlier this week because there were still 18 bison out of the west side of the park that we brought back into the park yesterday, I believe.
When you say we brought back into the park, does that mean you artificially or encouraged them to come into the park?
We did. The best scenario is if the bison will come back into the park on their own accord because the landscape is ready to receive them. The grass is greening up and they come back in. This year was a very hard winter. There was a lot of snow on the ground. They were not anxious to come back into the park.
So you haze them back in. The reason I ask the question is my understanding is the Park Service runs under something called a natural philosophy, my words. Mm-hmm. I assume you wouldn't haze them out of the park at some point.
We don't.
Okay.
In some years, they don't go out of the park in any great numbers. This past year, because of the heavy snowfall, there were many more bison that went into the Gardner Basin, for example, in the months of March and April.
But I guess what I'm raising is the question of a different philosophy depending upon where the bison are standing. If they're outside the park, you're willing to move them. But if they're inside the park, you let them manage themselves. Is that fair or not fair?
That's fair. And the only reason we engage with the state is that we have an agreement. We have basically a court-mediated settlement with the state of Montana and the between the state of Montana, the Department of Agriculture, and the National and the Department of Interior that basically says we're going to manage bison, we're going to try to have them come back into the park by May 1st, you know, on the north side of the park, and by May 15th are our target dates on the west side of the park. So we help the state to accomplish that.
Let's talk about another non-controversial species, wolves.
Wolves is, once again, a great success story. I mean, we have, they've been taken off the threatened and endangered species list. They're now a population in the park of about 95 wolves, probably in the ecosystem of about 450 wolves, and in the three-state area of probably 1,500 to 1,600 wolves. Each of the three states has a hunting and trapping season, which is something we're not opposed to, because we understood from the time that they were listed that the goal was to delist them. That would include that opportunity. We work very, very closely with the state of Montana to try to talk about what the hunt and trapping season might look like in Montana. Wyoming, we do the same thing. And I think we have great relationship with both states. I think we have an understanding that hunting and trapping of wolves on the boundaries of Yellowstone National Park is a different situation than it might be in the middle of either Montana or Wyoming.
I'm around the issue somewhat in terms of the people I talk to. I don't know anybody else that's called it a success, meaning that there are polarized interests out there. I think some are all or nothing interests. And the two examples you just gave, Wyoming has, as I remember, a pretty aggressive wolf control approach, rather than in contrast to Montana's. So when you see something like that, is it, I mean, one might say, we can't control that, we're the national park. One biologist might say somebody's being too aggressive. Is there any interface there, or you just say that that's up to the states?
Well, there's a lot of interface. We work very closely, and let's use Montana as an example. We work very, very closely with Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. Last year when they came out with their, for the season of 13-14, when they came out with their proposed hunting and trapping regulations, we talked with the Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Commission. We worked to influence the decision-making process that they had.
Through the biological data that you collect?
Absolutely.
You found them receptive to that sort of information?
I think everyone's receptive to science-based decision-making. I think it's easier in some places to apply that science information than it is others, but I was very, very pleased with the discussions we had with Montana last year. I think we made some very positive steps for the wolves. There's two different economies that we have to look at here. We have to look at sort of the tourist-based economy that mm-hmm. happens with wolves around Yellowstone National Park, as well as the sportsman's interest that happens. But that's all secondary to really the ecological benefit that wolves provide to this ecosystem.
When you say the ecological benefits of wolves to the ecosystem, what specifically are you talking about?
I'm talking about the fact of the predator-prey relationship that's been reestablished in large part to the reintroduction of wolves into this ecosystem. The fact that they are very important to the natural dynamic that happens, and you see it every day in the Lamar Valley. You see it play out in terms of the wolves' interaction with elk, with bison. They are a natural check and balance on populations. They help us in terms of regulating, if you will, to some extent, what the population numbers are, you know, in the park.
And the impacts that, let's say, elk populations might have on overgrazing along the river and that sort of thing?
Exactly. You're seeing a different vegetation structure out there today than you saw 20 years ago because of the grazing habits and the differences between elk and bison.
Tell us what's going on with native fish in the park.
Well, native fish conservation is a real focus of Yellowstone National Park right now, both on Yellowstone Lake, where we have non-native lake trout, which really have had a great impact on the cutthroat trout populations. They've had an impact on the spawning streams. They've had an impact on, by not having as many cutthroat trout in the spawning streams, it impacts the grizzly bears, it impacts osprey, otters, et cetera. A lot of species of animals that oftentimes feed and depend on the cutthroat trout spawning. Lake trout are, as non-natives, they live differently. For example, they spawn in the lake. They live at lower depths. So we've had a very, very aggressive program for the past about 4 years where we are actively gill netting and live trapping lake trout. We've removed, in the past 3 years, we removed over 850,000 lake trout. We're seeing some early signs of a recovery of the cutthroat trout. We have some of our census data shows us that we have more numbers of small cutthroat trout in the lake right now than we've had in the last few years. So we're very encouraged by what's going on. In addition to that, we're also trying to restore native fish to the streams. A lot of work's going on in the Lamar Valley on Slough Creek, Soda Butte Creek.
Would these be cutthroat as well?
They are cutthroat trout, mm-hmm. and there's a hybridization going on with those fish with rainbow trout. And so we're trying to build, enhance some fish barriers so we can remove the non-natives and allow the cutthroat trout and the West Oak cutthroat trout to not only survive, but to really thrive in those streams.
In the state of Montana, those sorts of efforts often run into conflict and controversy. Do you have that sort of thing to deal with here or not?
We have it to deal with a big time. Really, I would say in many ways, there is a contingent of people out there who just want to catch a fish, and they don't care what that fish is. But ecologically, the cutthroat trout, the native fish, have a lot more importance to that fishery than the non-natives do. We have the ability to restore the native fish populations and to remove the non-natives. I think it's incumbent upon us, you know, to do that. And the streams that I just mentioned up in the Lamar Valley are great examples of where we think we can have great success in restoring the native fish populations to those streams and removing the non-natives.
There was a book written not too long ago called The Last Child in the Woods. We're raising a generation of kids educated by video games. What is your expectation for their interest in the natural world in general and the national park system, and what, if anything, can you do about it?
While visitation remains strong in Yellowstone National Park, I'm really concerned about who those visitors are. I see people, traditional visitors to the park, but I'm not seeing what we typically call millennials. I think we are, as a National Park Service, are looking overall at how we reach out and make people understand the value of national parks and encourage and invite a new generation of visitors to the national parks to create future stewards for our national parks. I think we're trying very hard through education programs we have in the park. I think we're not going to the adventure recreation in places like Yellowstone National Park. We believe that they'll see value in the passive recreation and hiking and camping and enjoying the most incredible display of wildlife. In a place like Yellowstone that has half the world's geysers and over 10,000 thermal features, it truly is a unique place with incredible things to offer to new generations. We're trying to make them aware of these kind of places, what they have to offer, and hopefully they can see themselves, you know, making this part of their vacations, of their American experience, to really become connected with a place like Yellowstone.
Superintendent Dan Wink, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for having us here to Yellowstone.
My pleasure. Thank you, Brian.
And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.